Hello, Studio 360 listeners. It's Kurt. And if you haven't had a chance yet, check out this little bonus in your podcast feed. Our new podcast called Sideshow. It's all about arts and culture and entertainment and the best memes on the internet. We've been calling it Studio 360's Weird Kid Brother. And we mean weird in the good sense, the kind of kid brother who's precocious and funny and knows a lot of cool things. Is that patronizing? You can find out more at pri.org/sideshow. And if you like what you hear, I hope you'll subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever. See you this weekend.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
This is Sideshow, a podcast from Studio 360. I'm Sean Ramisferum. It's a pretty good time to be a white rapper. Mac Miller, Macklemore, Action Bronson, they don't really need to fight for their standing or face too many comparisons to Vanilla Ice. Even fringy weirdos like Kitty or Riff Raff get lots of attention. But 10 years ago, Hot Carl kinda got screwed.
Heard it would be easy if I just gave in, but I couldn't live with myself if I just caved in. I've heard that I'm stuck fighting a lost cause. At least I'm being honest, show the world I got some balls. I heard this is my heart and soul all on one track. I've heard a lot of things, but all I want to do is rap.
Hot Carl's real name is Jensen Karp. He was a white rapper from the Los Angeles suburbs who defied the odds and got a $1 million record deal at Interscope. But this was the early aughts. Eminem was still huge and dark, and Interscope quickly decided they didn't know what to do with Jensen, this quirky Jewish guy who rapped about David Lynch movies.
Back in the day, if you met any white rapper, they had sort of an effect on their voice that made them sound like other rappers, you know, that made them sort of seem like they were emulating things they'd seen from gangster movies. And I just sat there and was like, my name's Jensen. You know, I sound like a Muppet.
The label sat on Jensen's Muppet music for a while, and eventually he asked to be released from his contract. Interscope said yes. He was feeling pretty awful about the music business at that point, but thanks to the runaround, he did have a ton of money. And what he decided to do with that money is the best part of this sad rap saga. Jensen got together with his pal Katie Cromwell and opened Gallery 1988, an art gallery dedicated to pop culture fan art. Katie had the art gallery experience, and Jensen was the pop culture superfan. Gallery 1988's most recent show celebrated the 30th anniversary of Ghostbusters. There were stunning collages that could easily replace the original movie poster. There was a life-sized Slimer sculpture and dozens of beautiful, colorful prints of characters in both familiar situations and original ones inspired by the movies.
Do, re, mi, ga.
This Ghostbusters show was a huge success. Almost all of the artwork has sold out, and tons of people showed up to appreciate the work alongside fellow fans. It's been the same for nearly every Gallery 1988 show since they opened in 2004.
We knew that we had, you know, imagery that we thought people would like to see. We knew we were doing something different. It had never been done before. But, neither of us predicted the success we would have, no.
Gallery 1988 has had shows dedicated to Breaking Bad, Back to the Future, Beastie Boys, you name it. Each one draws huge crowds, but the space is also a huge hit online. The gallery is to thank for thousands of slideshows that have popped up on just about any site that likes web traffic. Prints and sculptures of Jesse Pinkman and Marty McFly may not have the originality of a masterful Murakami, but they have something better. They trigger that profound connection you have to the shows and musicians and movies you loved as a kid or as a binge-watching, couch-owning adult. I asked Jensen how he finds his artists and how he figured out how to give the people exactly what they want.
Well, at first we started to show artists that we just liked. There was a guy named Plastic God who was in our first show ever, and he basically made these digital canvas pieces of famous Lego heads. He would take musicians and movie stars and stuff and turn them into these 5x5-inch Lego head canvases, and they were awesome. And we had another artist named ESM Artificial that was a screen printer out of Canada, and he was doing a ton of Top Gun hits of incredible stuff and had never really been seen in galleries before. So right off the bat, we had him in our first show, and we just knew what spoke to us, and I'm a big pop culture guy, so we just let him go free.
Were they already making careers out of the art they were making?
No, not careers. I mean, they were trying. There was just really no avenues for them to do it. I mean, there was no such thing as like an Etsy or a, you know, community online to show this stuff. So we basically were looking online, trying to find as much personal websites as possible. We were going to art shows, just trying to find artists we liked. And then from there, say, did you ever think about painting pop culture stuff? And that's sort of how the process went at first.
Initially, it seems like you were catering to your own tastes. Did you realize that so many people out there shared this taste? I mean, it might have been obvious, but it also, I'm sure to several like gallery owners in Los Angeles, it seemed like the farthest thing from obvious.
Oh my God. I mean, to me it was obvious, but to no one else. You know, we heard from other art galleries, you know, established ones in LA, that we were like the ugly stepchild who, you know, was just doing group shows, and we got dogged by a bunch of people. So I don't think it was like a no-brainer for us. I just thought if we put up works that we would hang in our house, our friends would buy it. And that's sort of where we went from.
What have the biggest shows been? I know Breaking Bad, Arrested Development, Ghostbusters have all been huge recently, but what have been the biggest shows for Gallery 1988?
Well, we had an agreement with Disney years and years ago, probably 7 or 8 years ago, to be consultants for their company. And that created a show called Remixing the Magic, which not a lot of people know because it happened before sort of the boom of pop culture art sort of took mainstream. But Disney allowed us to create paintings based on anything from their library, which is bonkers. That includes Song of the South. Luke Chu did a piece for Song of the South, and Miss Van did a piece where the girl was in a Mouseketeer's hat and had no top on, and everything got cleared and everything was approved. And that show to me is, I look back and I'm like, how did that happen?
Huh. Have you ever run into the opposite phenomenon where the studio says, oh, you know, we have something planned for Ghostbusters in like 4 years, so we'd rather you do this than no thanks?
Well, we've never actually pitched someone.
Okay.
It's actually kind of a weird phenomenon. The only thing we've ever pitched in 10 years is Breaking Bad. I got in a room with Vince Gilligan and pitched him with the help of the people at Sony. But everything else that's ever happened for our company has been pitched to us. So we've said no to a lot of things. I mean, we said no to 2 and a Half Men and a bunch of other things that just don't make sense for our brand. But I mean, we're very lucky, knock on desk, to not be out there knocking down doors. You know, they're calling us in. So
do fans, do purists ever have a negative reaction to what you guys do?
No, I mean, because we're like half and half. I mean, sometimes Ghostbusters, we would have done on our own. You know, that's a given. And
yeah,
we rarely do projects, you know, we rarely do projects that we wouldn't do if not with the company. We say no to more than we say yes to. So we're big fans of the TV show Fringe. So we did something with J.J. Abrams for Fringe a couple of years ago. I mean, we basically just, you know, do things that we're fans of. So the only thing I think we get brushback on is being told we're not real art because we're like pop culture enthused. But
sure,
that's what I love. I mean, I love it when people tell us we're not art because they're the reason we created what we did. I mean, that's where the concept for the Gallery 1988 came from, which was, you know, Katie's gallery that she worked at that, you know, looked at us like terrible people. I'm stoked when people doubt, you know, the ability of pop culture to be hung in people's homes.
Some of the works that seem to really resonate seem to be from this magical period in the mid to late 80s and early to mid 90s. I'm wondering if you think there's something very special about this very specific time, or is it just that everyone who's in their 20s and 30s now and works in media all feels the same way about all the pop culture references that came out of that era?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a weird mix of both. I mean, I think that I'm part of that generation, so I genuinely think it's great pop culture-wise and media-wise. But I also think we're the first generation to have the internet and connectivity for our fandom. I mean, I don't know if like when my parents were younger, if people loved Some Like It Hot so much that they wanted to meet up and talk about it, but maybe they did. And the internet gives us that opportunity to take more than just, I love this movie. You could go further than that and communicate.
And is that why you named your gallery Gallery 1988, or did something very special happen in 1988?
The initial name that we wanted was Anthony Michael Hallway, and our lawyer was like, you can't do that. So at the last minute, we wanted to have something that felt the same way as sort of, you know, tributing Anthony Michael Hall. And 1988 just came to mind. It was a year the Dodgers won out here, the Lakers won, Wayne Gretzky came to the Kings, Beetlejuice came out, NWA came out with their big album. So it was just sort of a nod to a bunch of pop culture things that we loved, and that gave you a small inkling into what we were going to be.
So a lot of celebrities show up to your Gallery 1988 shows.
Yeah.
Who have I seen? Seth Rogen, Judd Apatow,
sure.
Aaron Paul.
Yep.
Has Michael Anthony Hallway ever shown up?
No. It's funny because I met him. There was a small time when I got out of college. I wrote some TV, you know, trying to figure out what Hot Carl was going to do next. And one of the things I did sort of was advertise a rapper's trying to write TV. And it actually got a lot of attention. And one of them was I wrote Monday Night Raw for WWE. And our show that came on after us on like the USA Network or wherever we were at the time was a show like The Dead Zone or something with Michael Anthony Hall. He was there. And I went up to him and introduced myself and shook his hand. I was like, hey, man, I'm a huge fan. I was like, there was one point in my life when I was going to open this business and have it be your name. And he like didn't even let me finish a sentence. He just like walked away. And I was like, well, it's probably better I didn't do that.
I was going to ask if now with all your clout in like L.A., if you could actually pull it off and change the name of Gallery 1988.
I
guess
now
not.
Unfortunately, we make money. Now he has something he can take.
But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain and an athlete
and a basket case, a princess
and a criminal.
Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Breakfast Club.
Thanks for listening to Sideshow, and thanks to David Krasnow, Jenny Lawton, John DeLore, and Hannah Alonji. You can find this podcast and three other really great ones at soundworks.org. Subscribe like it's going out of style. There's a lot more Sideshow at studio360.org/sideshow, and we are on Twitter at Sideshow.
Sideshow is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.